Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm State Impact Education Reporter Sammy Mann.
This program is it's a different kind of Sunshine Economy program. We will be talking a lot about a core economic issue, education, just not in direct economic terms. You know, Sammy, almost every conversation about the South Florida economy winds up including a talk about education, the education of the workforce here, the quality of the school systems to attract and retain high-quality jobs. Now, last week, we learned that the U.S. job market nationwide, by one measurement, has actually rebounded fully from the depths of the Great Recession. The number of jobs created since the recession ended is now equal to the number of jobs lost during the economic collapse.
But the recovery is lumpy, to say the least. The job gains have been concentrated among those with at least some college education or more. The number of people who have just a high school diploma, or not even that, and a job remains well below what it was before the recession.
Yeah, they've been hit hard and continue to be hit hard. Employment is just one of the economic issues around education, but so is equality. It's been 60 years now since the U.S. Supreme Court required public schools to be desegregated, but many schools remain isolated today. And we will talk in this program with students today about the color in their classrooms. One of the biggest challenges that comes to all Florida public classrooms next year is Common Core state standards. Now, these are those new, more rigorous education standards, Sammy, that have been rolling out in some grades over the past couple of years. The aim, of course, is to better prepare students for college and careers.
But in Florida, don't call these standards Common Core. We spoke with Robert Runcie, superintendent of Broward County Schools, via Skype from his office in Fort Lauderdale.
Let me just say the new Florida standards are essentially Common Core standards is the foundation of it. And the state has made some modifications to it. They've made about 90 or so tweaks, some of it in math and in writing. But in essence, it is fundamentally, I believe, Common Core based. Common Core is a good thing for our students. It's a good thing for this country. It's a shift away from just focusing on, I would say, teaching to the test versus teaching to the skills.
When the governor pushes for what he calls next generation Sunshine State standards, the Florida State Legislature passed a law that essentially eliminates the phrase Common Core from a Florida education policy. But yet the standards that you, your staff, and your teachers will be utilizing next year are 98% Common Core. Why such resistance from using the phrase Common Core, do you think?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot. I would say that there are some groups, individuals, and other parties who were probably misinformed about what Common Core is and what the intent of it is.
Would you include the governor and Florida Republicans that supported this legislature eliminating the phrase Common Core from state policy as among those uninformed about it?
No. I don't think they were uninformed at all. I applaud the legislature and the governor for retaining the core, the elements of Common Core, and even enhancing that to make it even stronger. I believe that they didn't want to be in a constant mode of having terminology be a distraction from the goal.
And there are still bigger stakes here. Part of that is that we had been preparing for one standardized test, but now we're going with one being prepared by the American Institutes for Research, which is a completely different test.
Yeah, that's going to be a huge shift. And so this coming year is essentially going to be a baseline year. It's going to be a level setting year for all of us. Listen, I would have preferred to have the state go through a 2-year transition process where we could actually work through this in a reasonable way, give districts and educators an opportunity to modify the professional development to align benchmark assessments as well as the summative assessments that we have, instructional materials, everything that's required.
And when you say benchmark and summative assessments, for somebody who has a kid in school, can you explain what that means?
Right. So essentially, you can view FCAT as a summative assessment. It's an end-of-year assessment. It's cumulative in terms of what it's actually assessing. But you can't wait till the end of the year to figure out where you are.
You still haven't seen the test up close that you're going to have to be giving next year.
No. Yeah. So that's the mystery box. But I will tell you this. Since we know that it's 90% Common Core in the foundation, we've been transitioning to Common Core for about 3 years now. We're going to continue that process and we'll recognize that it's not going to be that fundamentally different. We need to have an assessment that allows us to compare where our students are across all districts, not only within the state of Florida, but across the nation to the extent possible.
And that
And
was
yeah.
one of the and that was one of the goals behind setting up Common Core goals, was so you could
Right.
compare Florida public school students with those in New York and those in
That's,
Utah. Are
yeah.
you confident, as the leader of Broward County Schools, that the Utah assessment that will be majority used in the state of Florida will allow that kind of cross-state border comparison?
You know, we'll have to take a closer look at how that evolves. At the moment, I really don't have, you know, a solid opinion of what that's going to look like.
So with all of this, with that so-called mystery box, as you referred to when it comes to the assessment, what's the takeaway? What's the message to parents and to teachers over the next 2.5 months as they look forward to the next school year?
You know, we're going to use common sense. We're not going to get caught up on whether it's Common Core or it's called the New Florida Standards. We recognize that we've been in a world that has focused probably too much on a certain type of testing standards, memorization, and we're moving away from that culture.
Well, just on a very practical level, next year there's going to be a huge digital transition. All of these tests are going to happen online, on computers. The kids are going to have to be on the computers to take them. How prepared do you feel for that huge infrastructure need?
That infrastructure need is a very real one. We're very concerned about that. In Broward County, I will tell you that over 60% of our computers are older than 5 years. That's about 90,000 units. We have about 35,000 computers that are more than 8 years old. In addition to that, we need to upgrade our infrastructure. So there's basically three things that are required for success on the technology side. We need newer computers. We need more computers so we can reduce the student to computer ratio, because when it's we are we're 5-to-1, which is pretty high. So that means you've got more days of testing, which eats up instructional days that you can have. And we've got to upgrade the infrastructure that we have so we can handle the additional capacity.
Florida lawmakers have set aside $40 million for technology in the state budget, which means about $250,000 for every single district. How much money do you think you need to get all of those pieces in place?
Well, yeah, that I believe what we're seeing is about $4 million for Broward. We put together a 5-year technology plan for the district to address those areas I just mentioned to you. And that need over a 5-year period is somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million. Broward County could have swallowed up the entire state allocation and still had enormous need left to address.
Broward County Schools would like to borrow $800 million and will ask voters this fall to approve that. You've got about a $3 billion operating budget this past year. By my look at it, in the back of the envelope, you spent more on your interest costs than you spent on capital improvements this past year. How did this hole get so large with your capital needs?
The hole got so large because if we look back to a very pivotal year, it was 2008, 2009, that the state legislature reduced the millage rate from $2 per $1,000 worth of assessed property value to $1.50. That change eliminated about $1.8 billion worth of capital funding capacity over the last 6 years. So as a result, a larger portion of what we've had has been dedicated to debt service, leaving very little for capital needs. Capital needs being technology, school safety related items, and renovations on our facilities. We got over 32 million square feet of school space out here.
Superintendent, what's the bond load right now? How much debt does Broward County Schools have currently?
You know, it's around, I guess I'd say somewhere around 240 or so million dollars at the current moment. That's I believe that's what the current debt level is.
We've got to ask you about fiduciary responsibility. As you know, the history of Broward Schools recently has been very troubled when it comes especially to construction and facilities financial management. 3 years ago, a state grand jury found, quote, reckless spending of taxpayer money, culture of corruption, little regard for quality, accountability, or fiscal responsibility. In all fairness, this predated your administration at Broward County Public Schools. But what kind of assurances have you put into place that you can tell voters this fall the $800 million that you are asking voters to borrow over the course of the next several years and pay back over the course of the next three decades will be responsibly spent?
We have made a number of reforms in the facilities area. We had an independent management review that was done where we modified all our contracts to ensure that they were structured to best protect the district. We've been changing our processes there. We've made leadership changes. This is a new board. I'm a new superintendent here. We've got a new management team. We will also put in place a citizens oversight committee that will include a broad cross-section of individuals in the community. We will do quarterly briefings and reporting out to them. The other piece that will occur is that we're going to be very transparent about what actually is going to be done at each school, exactly how the $800 million are going to be spent and where. It's a level of documentation and commitment that has never occurred in a district.
Superintendent, will you require multiple bids for the projects that would dip into this $800 million bond money if the voters approve of it?
Absolutely. That is the only way to go. We have to make sure that we're getting the best market pricing in terms of what it will cost to do this work. We're also going to make sure that we have the best quality that's available. We can't afford to do anything less. We cannot hold this district hostage. We cannot hold our students hostage to the behaviors of a few people that occurred in the past. We can't jeopardize their future because of what somebody did in the past. And our students deserve better. We're committed to giving them that.
Robert Runcie is the superintendent of Broward County Public Schools. We invited Miami-Dade County Public Schools Superintendent Alberto Carvalho to participate in the interview, but the scheduling didn't work out.
Still to come on the program, changing classrooms, remembering the path to desegregation 60 years after a landmark Supreme Court ruling.
I'm a pessimist from the standpoint of I think that we could do better, but I'm an optimist in hopes that we will.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm State Impact Education reporter Sammy Mack.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Oliver Brown lived in Topeka, Kansas. He was a welder and an assistant minister. His 8-year-old daughter, Linda, went to Monroe Elementary. She walked through a Rock Island Line rail yard to get to her bus stop. That's when a bus showed up at all. Sumner Elementary School, though, was just 5 blocks from the Browns' house. In 1951, Oliver Brown, along with a dozen other parents, sued the Topeka Board of Education. They argued the segregated public schools in Topeka, Kansas were unconstitutional. And 3 years later, similar cases were all brought together to the U.S. Supreme Court, and 60 years this year, the High Court ruled unanimously that racial segregation of public school kids violated the U.S. Constitution.
Oliver Brown's name lent itself to a historic ruling. The decision of Brown versus the Board of Education is a seminal point for public education throughout the country. No longer was it legal to separate kids based upon the color of their skin. That was in 1954. A recent ProPublica investigation found at least 300 school districts that are still under court-ordered desegregation. 11 of those districts are in Florida. Even though Miami-Dade County was cleared relatively recently in 2001, it was an early leader in desegregation, putting black and white children and black and white teachers in the same schools. Mamie Pinder was one of those teachers. She remembers the early days of desegregation. In 1963, she was a first-time classroom teacher. And a note to listeners, this piece contains some strong language.
Every week, we were used to having anywhere from 3 or 4 bomb threats. The siren go off, the fire department come.
Pinder taught fourth grade at the previously all-white Alapata Elementary School.
I had one little white boy whose name was Willie Finch.
Early on, Pinder visited Willie Finch's house to talk to his parents about his poor schoolwork, and Finch got mad.
I always remember Finch, because Finch was the only one who called me an old black Negro, nigger. I said, you know what, I got to do better. I started saying in the lunchroom, who want my milk? Or who want my sandwich, you know? Finch got at least half of the time, gave him more. And he loved me more. When it was time for him to leave, he cried like a baby.
Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954, but the process of desegregation happened over decades. A year after Mamie Pinder started at Alapata, Retha Boonfai became one of just a couple dozen black students at Miami Jackson Senior High. She was an eighth grader with mostly white classmates.
You could tell the ones that really did not want us there. In fact, some of them transferred out.
She remembers a lunch counter across from campus that refused to serve black students. The entire football team, black and white students, threatened to boycott. And the lunch counter changed its policy.
And, you know, we went over and found out the food wasn't that hot anyways. So that was that.
The desegregated high school challenged Boonfai's own stereotypes.
Previously, we had been told that if we went to white schools, that they were smarter, that they were bigger, better, and faster. It was then that I found out that there were smart people and there were dumb people on both races. And so that to me was, something that I really discovered.
A few years later, in 1971, Ellen Elias had black schoolmates for the first time at JFK Junior High. And for some of the black children, it was their first time in school with Jews.
I had to go up to the board to do something. And this African-American girl called me a kike. It was like a stage whisper. And so I turned around and I'm like, what did you call me?
The girls agreed to meet in the field behind school and fight. When class let out, their friends circled around them.
We sort of started, the pulling the hair. We were wrestling, and neither one of us could beat each other up.
They went at it for a few minutes, ruining their clothes.
And we just sort of were rolling around, and we're like, this is stupid.
So they dusted off, and the entire crowd, both posses of friends, introduced themselves. The other girl in the fight was named Lorraine. And after the fight, the two became friends, real friends. Later in the semester, Elias spent a week in the hospital after surgery, and Lorraine made sure Elias was cheered up.
Her father had a flower shop, and every day in the hospital, I get a fresh yellow roses, because she knew yellow was my favorite color.
Elias is a teacher now, and decades after that fight with Lorraine, Elias watched as her daughter had a different experience of diversity at the same school.
I think part of it made me into the kind of person I am in terms of how I treat other people. Also, certainly how I parent my child, because she went to JFK Middle School. She went to school with almost all black kids. And at her bat mitzvah, it was a rainbow of faces. I think that's kind of cool, that she's much more exposed to people who are different from her. When I do the Supreme Court cases, each student presents a different case. And we talk about the impacts of those cases, and then we look around the room and we're like, you wouldn't be here if Brown versus Board of Education hadn't passed. There's another case, a Title IX, women in sports, and I have some amazing female athletes in my classes. And so we always look at the impact, and the students really are very aware of whose shoulders they're standing on.
Retha Boonfai has a more ambivalent take on the legacy of Brown.
The legacy was supposed to be equal educational opportunity, but unfortunately that has not happened because you still have poor people who have poor schools. You still have issues where equal education is not across the board. I wish that it were so. We may be getting better, but at this point, that to me, the legacy has not been borne out. I'm a pessimist from the standpoint of I think that we could do better, but I'm an optimist in hopes that we will. The kids today don't quite understand the struggle that their parents had to go through, and I think that's a good and a bad thing. The good part about it is that they don't have that background to hold them back, but the bad part about it is they don't remember to appreciate where they are. And maybe, like I said, that's good and bad.
Looking back on those early days, Mamie Pinder believes that much of how desegregation played out in the classroom began in the home.
One day I spent the time asking each of my kids, who are black and white now, what color are you? What color are you? You get pink, brown, blue. You don't get black or white from kids. Kids are taught. It's a true saying. In the home. The home is the first school of education. What that child is taught in the home is what that child brings into the world.
For these three, desegregation is part of who they became. Mamie Pinder was the first black woman to run for mayor in Miami. Retha Boone Phi, the Jackson student, is the executive director of Miami-Dade's Black Affairs Advisory Board, and Ellen Elias now teaches Brown versus Board of Education to her AP government class at Dr. Michael Kropp Senior High.
Still to come on our program, common challenges, changing classrooms, public education in the Sunshine Economy. South Florida schools may be integrated, but some remain isolated.
How do the schools look now, today, compared to in the summer of 2001 when a judge lifted a court integration order for Miami-Dade?
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm State Impact Education reporter Sammy Mack.
It's a little bit of a different kind of program today. Common challenges, changing classrooms, public education in the Sunshine Economy. And it comes here this first official Monday of summer vacation. So let us know what summer vacation means to you. After a long school year, summer vacation is like, fill in the blank. Send us a tweet at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy.
The Brown versus Board of Education decision came down 60 years ago, but the work of desegregation is not over. A Miami Herald analysis reveals many South Florida schools lack diversity. I spoke with the Herald's education reporter, David Smiley, about schools today that would have fit the definition of segregation.
Well, I like to call it isolation because I feel like segregation is a very loaded word, and schools in South Florida and around Florida have been integrated for decades now. But I took a look at the racial demographics of schools around the district, and what specifically I was looking for was how do the schools look now, today, compared to in the summer of 2001 when a judge lifted a court integration order for Miami-Dade. And specifically what I was interested in was how many schools today meet the court definition of an isolated school. They defined it an isolated school or a segregated school at 85% of black students. And so what we did find is that today about close to one in three black students will attend an isolated school that is 85% or more black students, and a little more than half of the district's Hispanic students will attend such a school.
And what does that mean for their classroom experience?
I think it means something different based on your age and also based on whether you're black or Hispanic. For Hispanic students, there was really a little obvious correlation between having an isolated Hispanic school and income levels or FCAP performance on reading, which is a metric that we use to try to take a look at the academic performance. But for black students, if you attended an isolated black school, you were almost guaranteed to attend a poor black school. In terms of academics, the younger you were as a black student in one of these schools, the lower your FCAT reading scores were.
Is this legal? Are the schools potentially putting themselves in some questionable territory here?
No, once the courts lifted the integration order, there is no judge to look over their shoulder and say, you know, what you're doing is incorrect. And there have been some grumblings in the black community, you know, just ahead of the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. There was a contingent of generally black organizations that came to the school board and did voice frustrations over what they felt was unequal treatment. The discussion was for largely black and Hispanic schools, but to a large extent, this was a discussion from the black community, feeling that the district to some extent has ignored its black schools or underfunded black schools or provided them with inferior programming.
What has the district's response been?
Well, when I spoke with district administrators about what we were looking at in terms of demographics in isolated schools, one of the things they spoke about was specifically academics and looking at the opportunities that they've afforded children in the school system. And a few things that are certainly worth mentioning when anytime you're going to take a look at demographics and whether schools are isolated is one, almost one in three children in Miami-Dade County have a choice, quote-unquote, option, where there are about 50,000 students in charter schools and 50,000 students in magnet programs. To a great extent, in 2013-2014, children who, even if you stay at your home school, you're making a choice, essentially, to stay at your home school.
How does this play out in magnet schools and in charter schools?
For magnet schools, we don't entirely know because the district doesn't keep track of the demographics of magnet programs within schools. But for charter schools, well, charter schools are more integrated generally than your traditional public schools. One thing I did notice is that charter schools have a noticeably lower enrollment for black students than traditional schools. There's about a 23% enrollment of black students across Miami-Dade County. It's about 13% for charter schools.
You documented the story of Orchard Villa Elementary School, which was really important in desegregation in South Florida. Can you tell that story?
Orchard Villa was the first all-white public school in Florida to integrate. And that happened about 5 years after the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, when Adelie Range, who would become Miami's first black woman commissioner, she and a few other families began to push the district to allow their children into Orchard Villa, which was their neighborhood school, serving Liberty City, which was becoming more and more of a black neighborhood. And they pushed the district to allow the first four black children into an all-white school at Orchard Villa. And very quickly, within 2 months, all of the remaining white families who had students at that school had pulled out their children. And the district chose to transfer in several hundred black students and overhaul the staff to make it completely black. Instead of becoming an integrated school, it flipped from being an all-white school to an all-black school, and is generally held up today as sort of the evidence of the initial failures of integration. It became a story about the resistance against integration.
David Smiley with the Miami Herald. You can find an interactive tool to see the demographic breakdown of your school at miamiherald.com.
And you can send us a tweet filling in the blank on this sentence. After a long school year, summer vacation is like. Send that tweet at WLRN. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy. Still to come on our program, we hear from current South Florida students about today's classrooms 6 decades after desegregation. It's Common Challenges, Changing Classrooms, Public Education in the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm State Impact Education reporter Sammy Mack. This year marks the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. But as we've heard this hour, not all students learn in diverse classrooms. We gathered a panel of 4 South Florida students to hear about the role of diversity in their educations.
Hi, my name is Adriana Cantos. I recently graduated from Atlanta Community High School in Delray Beach. I am Hispanic, and I will be attending the University of Notre Dame next year.
Well, hi. My name is Robert Burns. I'm a sophomore. I attend Gulliver Prep, class of 2017. Go Raiders. I'm from Homestead, Florida, and I am African American.
Hi, my name is Joshua Carter. Born and raised in Miami, around Hispanic culture. I recently graduated from Law Enforcement Officers Memorial High School, and starting fall, I will attend Tallahassee Community College and then transfer to Florida State University.
Hello, I'm Spencer Anderson. I just graduated from Atlanta Community High School, class of 2014. I'm an African American, and I was born and raised in Boca Raton, and I'm surrounded by Jewish and Caucasian culture, so this is interesting.
So you just heard the stories of folks who were in South Florida decades ago, who were here as students and teachers experiencing desegregation for the first time in South Florida. What do you hear when you hear these stories? Joshua?
I was raised in public schools, and the way that public schools set you up is you're going to be faced with a variety of different people, whether they're Caucasian, Hispanic, Black, Asian. It's a public school. It still depends on the teacher and their curriculum, so...
Robert, you've been in both public and private schools.
Correct.
What do you make of your experiences as opposed to some of what you just heard from folks decades ago?
Now, being in a private school, I think I'm able to see the diversity that she talked about. When I look around at my peers, most of my peers do not look like me. You're able to see different people from different cultures, from different backgrounds and different walks of life.
Spencer?
I can see. Okay, so one of the people were talking about how it wasn't completely successful and how poorer regions still have the conflict with the poorer and like desegregated schools. And we see that in action at our school, even though it's partially a magnet school, because The majority of our school are African Americans, and it is a poorer school in some sense. It's surrounded by poorer neighborhoods, and that part of the school, their education, I would not say, is equal to schools in Boca, such as West Boca, which is a much better school than that portion of regular Atlantic.
Adriana?
It's actually kind of interesting because in the IB section of my school, you really don't see much segregation or separation between students. We're all very friendly. We all talk to each other. But I feel like there's separation between the IB students and the rest of the school. And I think it kind of has to do with the socioeconomic factors rather than just like race alone. And I think that's what's causing more of a separation.
So do you see socioeconomics as a different kind of diversity than when you hear some of the other stories about race in the classroom?
I think it's a separate factor that affects segregation today more so than before, I think.
When we talk about diversity, Joshua, what do you think of when you think of diversity?
When I think of diversity, I think of people from different cultures, skin tone, height, weight. Diversity is just multiple different type of people in general, not specifically where they come from, but who they are as a person.
Yeah, I see you nodding along too,
yeah.
Robert. How else do you see diversity in the classroom?
I would have to agree with Joshua. I mean, diversity can be seen in many different ways beyond just the color of our skins. Diversity can be economic status. Diversity can be, you know, talent.
In elementary school and as well as middle school, which I went to Maya Angelou Elementary School and then Ponce de Leon Middle School, it's always been Hispanic-based, so I really see the pro of diversity because me as a young Black man, I got the opportunity to not only learn Spanish in the classroom, but also my friends become Hispanic. Like, my friends are Hispanic, so I learn Spanish from their homes. So with diversity, you get to grow as a person. So that's a pro in diversity.
Do you feel like you're getting enough of that in your classrooms, Joshua?
No. In my opinion, no. I mean, I really like multiple different type of people. I wish that diversity is everywhere. Though it is everywhere, which is, like, broader, you know.
And the school that you're at right now is about 70% Hispanic, 22% Black, and almost 6% white.
Correct.
Which is not so far off from the Miami-Dade County District averages.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a relatively new magnet school. In the middle schools and elementary schools that you were in beforehand, was it the same kind of mix of people?
Elementary school, yes, but when I went to middle school, it started to even out between the Hispanics and the African Americans.
And how did that change your experience in the classroom or even just socially with friends?
It honestly didn't change it at all because of since elementary school, I was surrounded by Hispanic people, so regardless, I stuck to Hispanic people, though I still hang out with African Americans and Caucasian people, so it's predominant Hispanic people in my life.
And what about in the lunchroom? Where do you guys sit? What does your table look like? Spencer?
We sit outside. The inside is very chaotic, but outside, it's generally Adrian and I, so Hispanics, Blacks, and Caucasians with a few Asians. So it's very diverse, the table itself.
And when you look at the rest of the lunchroom,
that's usually the rest of the school. Like, IB kids and the rest of the school don't really combine.
It's a partition physically and mentally almost.
And when you look at your lunchroom, what about who's sitting where at the tables? Joshua?
We all mingled with each other. It was no different sides at all. Like, all Hispanics sat with Blacks and then the Caucasians all together.
The lunchroom is really sort of a metaphor for the social dynamic. I'm looking at a bunch of high school students who are nodding along to this.
Yeah.
We all know, anybody who's been in high school knows the lunchroom is where the social structure happens.
Right.
For you, Robert, how is it different now that you're in this private school as opposed to when you were in a public middle school?
Obviously, I think the color of your skin, you see a lot more diversity. But I think even beyond that, I think the topics actually are pretty much diverse. The things that you actually talk about.
Like what?
I mean, looking back, when I was in public school, I mean, I could probably count on my fingers about the things that we would talk about. It would probably be like music or what's on TV nowadays. But when I look at my topics now, I mean, we're actually talking about philosophies and what colleges we want to go to.
Why do you think that's different now?
Well, I mean, looking at my school, I think there's so much differences. So comparing that to the public school, there's not much differences. Everyone sort of looks like you. Everyone sort of shares your kind of experiences or whatnot. But the private school setting, just me personally, from my experiences, the goals are different from my friends, per se, in public schools.
And speaking of goals, the state of Florida has race-based education goals for different students, depending on whether they're Black, White, Hispanic, Asian. By 2017, 80% of Hispanic students are expected to be performing in mathematics at grade level, whereas 86% of white students are expected to be at grade level, and 74% of African American and Black students are expected to be at grade level. And that has been a big conversation in the past year. When you guys hear that, what do you make of that, Joshua?
I mean, as a person, I don't necessarily agree to it because you don't know how people are. People could change.
I see you nodding along here, Spencer. What do you make of it?
I agree with him on the part from the pragmatic statistics standpoint that we should put a cap or like an expectation in order to start somewhere and achieve that goal, but from a personal standpoint, I think it's terrible. It's pretty much saying that they only want a certain, not that they want, but they're only aiming for a certain amount of students passing, whereas they should just aim for everyone. They should teach in order to have everyone pass these examinations and not just a certain cap. And also, it leads to self-fulfilling prophecy, saying that this amount of Asians will pass, showing that they're better at mathematics than Blacks or Caucasians, etc.
Adriana?
Yeah, I kind of agree with him with the self-fulfilling prophecies. It kind of affects everybody's point of view, saying, or even the teachers, when they see these statistics, they start thinking, oh, this kid is going to do worse, or maybe he won't pass, instead of seeing how everyone has that potential to pass. And I think it affects the way that they teach, how they act with other people, how they answer other kids' questions. So even numbers can affect how students can learn, in my opinion. So I feel like these numbers are actually making the education for students worse, but not really. It's more of like a subconscious thing. Like, people don't even realize they're doing it, but knowing the fact that maybe, oh, 25% of Hispanic kids won't pass, they're like, okay, well, maybe I don't need to put that much focus on the other kids or put more focus on Hispanic kids. Or they do that subconsciously, and it isn't giving equality to all the kids.
Have any of you felt that in the classroom?
Honestly, I did. Like I said, I've been taking Spanish as a course since elementary school. So as being a Black male, it's supposed to be harder for me. But it was actually different. I mean, it was actually rather easy to me. Like, Spanish just caught on, but maybe that's because of the people who I was surrounded with. Because nowadays, I go to my friend's house who are Hispanic nearly daily. So Spanish just rubs off on me. So in the class, is just easier. So, I mean, again, I guess it just depends on the person.
Yeah, and what about you, Robert?
Well, me personally, I think when I was in public school, if so, I think you can kind of just see a change in the atmosphere versus now being in private school. I think the atmosphere was a lot more lenient versus whereas, you know, you come in, you hear things like, well, from teachers, well, I'm just here to collect a paycheck or something, you know, whereas now in private school, you don't hear that. And I think one of the things that really hit me was that if you lower the expectations for students just based on the color of their skin, then you're really shortening the level of productivity that they can produce. You're really putting a limit on their success. And I think that's not fair. I think that the Brown versus the Board of Education, I think that was meant so that things like that wouldn't happen. And I think that if we go back and we try to put those expectations, that we're only going back from what, you know, history corrected.
When you guys learn about Brown versus Board of Education in the classroom, what do you think its legacy is now? How do you feel it in your own classes or not? Joshua?
Me, personally, I didn't hear about it until my ninth grade year because being in my school, we had to take a legal class. And in the course, we did read from the books, and actually the Brown versus Education was the case that really struck me the most, being as a black man, black male, and being not segregated at all, because I grew up around Hispanics and Caucasians, and I was surrounded by them. So honestly, I'm glad that that it happened, because now I am who I am today because of the desegregation, because of we're all together.
Adriana?
I felt like the intentions of the Brown versus the Board of Education were positive, and I think they did change the world in a positive state. But to a certain extent, we still see separation in kids today. But I don't think it's like the actual school doing this. It's rather the students separating themselves from other students. So you still kind of see the segregation.
So a self-segregation?
I think so.
What do you think it would take to break down some of those barriers?
I think kids should be experiencing diversity from an early age so they get accustomed to this. Because I feel like students sometimes separate themselves from other kids because of what they've been taught, or usually their background, who they already know. So if they're already exposed to diversity from an early age, then later on it's just normal for them.
What do you wish that the teachers and educators and the people who make decisions about how schools run understood about your experience of diversity in schools? Robert?
I wish that everyone would understand that diversity brings about a change mentally in the way that you look at life. If diversity, you know, wasn't as impactful as it has been, I don't think I would be the person I am today. I don't think that my best friend would be Hispanic, you know? I don't think that I would be able to talk and have the conversations with the people that I do today.
Joshua?
I can give a little background about me. About 2 years ago, in 2012, I was nominated to be one of the delegates to represent Florida and the Anti-Defamation League. And that's when I went to Washington, D.C. and met a wide variety of people from different backgrounds, from New York, Albany, Chicago, San Diego, to hear their stories and where they come from.
That one trip to D.C., how much of an impression did it leave on you? How much of who you are now is part of that?
A huge impression. I do not judge anyone, no matter what they do. I will sit down and get to know them as a person, even if they make a simple mistake or what someone would think is appalling. I would like to walk up to them and find out why, and get to see who they are as a person.
And that happened over how many days?
It was 4 days and 3 nights.
So it just took 4 days and 3 nights to make that kind of difference in you?
Yes.
So I want to ask all of you, what happens next for you guys? Adriana?
I will be attending the University of Notre Dame. I will be studying neuroscience, and maybe later on become some sort of doctor.
Well, good luck with that. And Robert, what happens next for you?
Well, I'll continue to go to Gulliver Prep, play football, in my pursuits of, you know, being a great football player, and hopefully just continue to speak out about desegregation and its impact.
Joshua?
Hopefully I would say, you know, stay in track and impact with the people from Anti-Defamation League.
Spencer, what happens next for you?
I'm off to Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island to study radiology. And I'm going to stay open-minded and spread open-minded thoughts.
Three graduating seniors headed off to college and one rising sophomore on Diversity in the Classroom. Have a great summer, guys.
But first, summer vacation begins today, absolutely. Still to come on our program, The Mirror in the Classroom, when education reflects our inequalities.
Schools can be a beacon, but more often, they are a mirror. They show us who we are.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm State Impact Education reporter Sammy Mack. School's out for summer, and all this hour we've been talking about how what happens in the classroom prepares students for life beyond school. And it is a diverse world out there. But 60 years after the Brown versus Board of Education ruling, not all classrooms reflect that diversity. Jeremy Glazer taught in Florida schools for years.
Here's a question. How do you teach a class of all black students in an all black school that Brown versus Board of Education ended segregation decades ago? That isn't a hypothetical question, but one I remember clearly asking myself. I was teaching American history for the first time in one of our nation's many embarrassingly homogeneous schools. I could not, with a straight face, teach my students that segregation had ended. They'd think that either they or I didn't know what the word segregation meant. But, as a beginning teacher, I was afraid of telling too much truth. Brown's legacy is not a hopeful story about law, government, or progress. And it seemed like a particularly cruel lesson in power, racism, and injustice. I wanted to be both honest and gentle to my students, and probably failed at both. I bumbled my way through that particular year in that particular school, but the question of segregation comes up again and again for me. Brown has always been in the background, whatever my students look like. And they've looked very different. I've been privileged to teach in a wide range of environments, city schools, suburban schools, public schools, and private, and I've worked with a wide range of students. In my travels, I've found that mixed schools are exceedingly rare. That's unfortunate, because if we're ever going to be a truly multicultural, tolerant society, we need to start by sitting next to each other. But proximity itself isn't the answer. It's just the beginning. Real mixing doesn't automatically happen, even if different students are brought together. I learned this lesson in a suburban school filled with a range of ethnic groups. There, I had an English class of mostly black and brown students first thing in the morning. I could never get them to listen to the announcements, and one day I asked why they weren't interested in the events going on in the school. One kid told me, "Those things aren't for us. Those are for the other kids." It was clear he meant the middle-class white kids, and that even though Brown had succeeded in desegregating this school in body, we had failed to do so in spirit. I continue to believe in the ideals behind Brown, which I think call for a truly democratic, equitable public school system. That doesn't just mean putting different kinds of kids near each other. Physical desegregation is only the first of many steps. There's a lot of work after that. But the longer we put off that first step, the further behind we fall. In education, I see too many people looking to find silver bullets in vouchers, charter schools, or even court decisions. There are no silver bullets. Schools can be a beacon, but more often they are a mirror. They show us who we are. As long as we live in a country where most of us only spend time with those who look like us, segregation remains a nightmare from which our schools cannot wake us. If we truly want to desegregate, then those of us with the power to choose need to decide that we no longer want to live separate, unequal lives. It's never too late to start.
Jeremy Glazer, a former South Florida school teacher. He's working on a doctorate of education at Stanford University.
It's never too late to start, not even during summer vacation. Are there any phrases that are as delightful as that? Summer vacation, rest, relax, reflect. Yeah, certainly. But in this competitive world, education simply can't sit still. Even if school is out, it has to improve, enhance, and advance our economy. After all, summer moves awfully fast. It'll be gone before we know it. Special thanks to our technical director, Wanda Miles. For Sammy Mack, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Summer's almost gone. Summer's almost gone. Almost gone. Yeah, it's almost gone. Where will we be when the summer's gone? Summer's almost gone.